Hey, thanks for tuning in to this Langerfam bonus track. As I mentioned in the main episode with Michael Arad, he was kind enough to introduce me to several researchers at the Max Planck Institute in Nijmegen. But before we listen to what they have to tell us about their research, how about we start with a little story? The story of the piano in the basement.
One day in late November, I was at lunch again with Charlotte, Mark, and his office mate, Edwin, who works on chimp behavior. "Sometimes I hear music being played, piano music," Edwin said, "but only after work hours." "Where is there a piano?" I asked. "In the basement," they said. "There's a basement?" I hadn't known. 2 days later, my oldest son came to the institute with me. There was a teacher's strike and he had no school. On such days, usually we sat for a while in my office, the door closed, while I wrote. He watched videos or looked at photos of trains on my desktop computer to sketch. Then at 10:30, we wandered down to the canteen for a muffin. That day, I suggested we explore the basement, and he agreed. But as soon as we started down the dark staircase, he balked. He's been like this, hesitant to enter spaces that might look forbidden. "There's no sign here," I said, "no reason to avoid this. Plus, there's the piano they were talking about. I have to see the piano." I persuaded him further down. As soon as we entered the hallway, a light snapped on. We crept along the corridor and found an entrance to the library's lowest stack, which we'd explored from above during a previous visit. "It's not the library," he insisted. "It is. It's the same," I said. "Magic bunny holes existed all over the institute. Do people map out routes using the basement to avoid others they don't want to see? If they don't, they could." We rounded the corner, looked into an office, and saw Jan, the head janitor. He's jolly, bald, plain talking, and friendly. Booming voice. "Hi, Michael!" He's the one responsible for all the physical systems. If it can be moved or can break, Jan is in charge of it. Don't take Jan for granted. The man has keys. "We're checking out the basement," I said. "I'd never been down here before." "Well, let me show you some other things," he said.
Well, now it's my turn to show you some other things that happen at MPI. Let's listen to Hans Rutger Boska, Mark Dingemanser, and Charlotte Horn. First up, Hans.
Hi.
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 Hi,
how are you?
Hans.
Nice to meet you. I'm Max.
Hi, nice to meet you. Enjoy me. It's much cooler down here, isn't it?
It's quite pleasant, yeah.
Upstairs.
Especially compared to two floors up.
Yeah. I've always been interested in speech, so not necessarily language per se, but rather the speech signal, the spoken signal. And most of my work is on speech perception, so how come... I mean, you can understand me right now perfectly well, because this is a quiet surrounding, right? And no problem there. But once we get into a situation where there's loud traffic competing talkers in a bar, or background music, or,
it's the worst.
or even just a non-native speaker, right? Someone who produces noise inside the signal, inside the communicative signal itself. Still, we somehow cope, right? We don't have that much struggle in a bar, or... So somehow we cope, and we do that much better than Google does, right?
Yeah.
And all these speech recognition softwares. I'm interested in speech perception, especially when it gets bad, right? When it gets difficult. So, for instance, one of the topics is very fast speech.
Hmm.
At some point, it breaks down, right? We can compress speech to a certain degree, make it really fast. But at some point, it breaks down. Now, why does it break down at a particular rate, right? What is it in the brain that fails then? I can produce a simple sentence and then speed it up by two and you have no problem, right? There's no... Acoustically, that's very, very different. Right? If you just look at the signal, it's completely different.
Yeah.
But we understand the same words. If we compress it by three, you still can kind of somehow pick up the words. But somewhere along, you know, when you compress it by four or five, we lose that intelligibility. It becomes too fast. Now, why is that, right? So we look at how the brain processes fast speech, for instance. Another topic is disfluency. So communication can also get difficult when there's lots of ums or pauses or breakdowns, those kind of things. And somehow the brain has developed kind of a clever way of dealing with those. So we've also done some research into, for instance, how the brain processes online, right? So we use, for instance, eye tracking research,
yeah,
where we show pictures, and we then present disfluent speech and see how that influences how people interpret the speech, right? Mm. Because the eyes follow what you think is going to come up. It's a picture of, say, a sewing machine, something really low frequent, right?
Okay.
Something that we don't see every day.
Yeah.
Spinning wheel, you know, very low frequency items. And high frequency items, so cars, bikes, that kind of thing.
Okay.
You see two pictures on the screen, that's it. And then you hear a sentence. Now click on the... it's not going to be the hand, right?
Yeah.
Because the high frequency eyes is not going to be difficult to name.
Mm.
So somehow we use those to already predict that it's going to be the difficult item well before we hear the S of sewing machine, or yeah, we hear the S and the P of spinning wheel, something like that, right? So it's evidence of that we actively use these kind of metacognitive,
yeah,
not metacognitive, but metalinguistic cues, these performance cues. Doesn't mean anything, but nevertheless,
but maybe it does, yeah.
The listeners can cleverly use, yeah, those symptoms of speech production in perception. Speech rate thing, we also use neurobiological methods. We've used EEG and MEG, which is measuring basically brain activity, right, at a given moment in time, and that has a very, very small temporal resolution, very good temporal resolution, so you can measure every millisecond what's going on in the brain.
Wow. Yeah.
And what we've been showing is that people actually track the rate of speech. So if we take a normal speech signal that has, I don't know, I say 5 syllables every second, then we actually see in the brain a kind of a 5 beats a second response.
Really?
As well.
Yeah.
So it's like the brain adjusts to what you hear.
Right?
Now, if you compress that by 2, you end up with 10 beats a second, and you again see the 10 beats a second back in the brain.
Yeah.
But once it gets too fast, so when we compress it by 3 or 4 or 5, we lose that correlation between brain and speech, basically. So it's like the brain tries to keep up, right, with the signal as it comes in. But somewhere it breaks down, and the moment it breaks down has been said to be relevant for the kind of brain waves that are in the brain. So the edge is around 10 hertz, right? Everything below 10 hertz is trackable, syllable rates below 10 hertz. And you'll find that languages all around the world will have syllable rates below 10 hertz.
They do, yeah.
And one reason might be, right, given all this neural stuff, that the brain has been designed to track rhythms within this range and not outside the range.
Yeah.
And therefore languages have evolved to be, you know, within that range. So it's like you can kind of fool the brain to, yeah, as long as you follow its rules, you can help it to understand speech.
Okay.
And ideally that's where you want to go, right? That's where, yeah, you want to go for, I don't know, hearing people with hearing aids, elderly people who lose some of their hearing acuity, cochlear implants. That's ideally where you want to go. Understanding how speech perception works, what are the constraints that the brain, for instance, imposes, or the ears, or whatever. And if we know, if we can understand that, then we can apply it, right? So it's, in the end, it's, of course, it's fundamental research, but it's driven by this idea of wanting to understand in order to be able to then tweak perception, right? All these languages, I mean, they're all spoken languages, so we all speak with our mouths, right? And our mouths constrain how we speak. We can only speak so fast. We can't speak at 10 hertz, right? So therefore, we also don't find that much.
Mm. But it looks fairly consistent. Is that true, or is that just the layman looking?
And that's the point, yeah, that across all languages, you know, this is just Dutch, but the theory is, the suggestion is that this is... general across the board, simply because this is how our jaws work, and maybe even how our brains work, right? Our brains can't keep up with 10 hertz, so why would you speak above 10 hertz?
Because sometimes there's this perception, at least, that some languages are quicker than others, you know, like Spanish, for example, would be the typical example.
Yeah,
and they sound so quick, but apparently that may just be individual perception.
That's clearly a perception issue, because if you do the math, right? If you look at the acoustics, the signals itself, they're very comparable.
Checks out.
There's also stuff on speech rate where it's all within the same range, but of course, perception deviates from merely objectively observing the world, right? If we listen to Spanish, we can't pick up the sounds, right? Because they might have sounds that we don't use.
Mm.
We don't hear the word boundaries. I mean, if you look at the speech signal, there's no pauses if we between don't know words, Spanish. Right?
Yeah, okay.
So it's very difficult to pick out the words simply because we don't know where they end. We just get a blur of sound and it's just like, what? So perceptually, that sounds a lot faster. And it's been called the gabbling foreigner illusion, right?
Oh, yeah.
This foreigner comes in, some Japanese, and everybody has this intuition that, it's faster. But of course, that can't hold because a Spanish person will think Dutch is fast, right?
Because it's a foreign language.
Exactly. Yeah. It can't be in the acoustics. It's clearly a perceptual phenomenon.
What that speech modulation curve also tells me is that it's probably very, very unlikely that someone who's an interpreter would have to be dealing with or resolving differences in modulation rates between their two languages.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. But that's mere acoustics, right? That's just listening to sound. Of course, there's much more when it comes to interpreting because you also have to understand the sound, pick out the words, make sentences in your mind, understand them, and then go all the way back, right? From that meaning, construct a sentence in a different language. So,
but it looks from your research like there's probably almost no difference between a professional language user, like an interpreter, let's say, and a normal person, because there are some kind of physical limitations to the rate that you can...
In terms of speech rate.
Sort of tolerate, yeah.
Yeah, of course, there's a range, right?
Yeah, because I would have said maybe, professional language user who has more training, maybe that makes
would
a difference.
Be faster,
but maybe it doesn't,
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, no, certainly. I mean, it's only a range, right? I'm just saying that extremely fast or extremely slow won't happen. And the reasons might be the jaw or might be the brain, right? But within that, there's still considerable variation, of course, right? If we are proficient speakers of a language, we're much faster than non-native speakers, and there's individual variation in people who are just generally slow and all that kind of things. So there's still, of course, considerable variation. Nevertheless, that variation is constrained, right?
Mm.
It doesn't go up to 15 hertz, it doesn't... So there are boundaries, and that's what we try to pinpoint, right? To limit the variability, because there's plenty of variation. Yeah.
A few floors up is Mark Dingemanser.
Mark,
hello.
Happy to meet Alex.
Hey, nice to meet you.
Mark,
how are you?
Nice to meet you. I'm going to step out and get some coffee.
Okay, sure.
So there are two main strands to my work. And the one that Michael mentioned, I think, is the one to do with... He mentioned this little word, huh?
Yeah.
That's the word that you use when you didn't quite catch what somebody said, right? Or at least it's one of the ways in which you can do that. It's the most informal way and the most widely used way. But the larger research program is more broadly about how we manage to communicate at all, against overwhelming odds. So much can go wrong and goes wrong all the time that it's kind of a miracle that we manage to, be able to talk somehow.
Even if you speak the same language.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. I mean, that's even without, thinking about all the formidable issues of different languages.
Mm.
But this is just about using a word that the other doesn't quite know, or using a name that has multiple possible reference. But also communicating in noise, of course, traffic passing by, all sorts of other trouble, overlapping. There are very many ways in which things can go wrong. And what's so interesting about human language as opposed to many other animal communication systems is we actually have pretty good ways to deal with that. We can do some of the same things that other animals also do. This is one of my interests, actually, animal communication and how language relates to that.
Yeah.
But animals' options are limited. So what they can do is basically just keep repeating what they did until they get some form of success.
Yeah.
Or give up.
Or not.
That's it. That's
okay.
It. And we can do that too, but fortunately we can do more.
Mm.
And so our research program into what we call repair was precisely aimed at trying to find out how exactly we solve these kinds of breakdowns.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the course of that, we discovered a couple interesting things, one of which was this little word, huh, which we found to be basically universal in spoken languages. And that was totally unexpected for us as linguists.
Yeah, absolutely. It
doesn't make sense at all that, you know, in unrelated languages you would have a word with a similar kind of function that also has a similar kind of sound. It doesn't work like that normally, as you as an interpreter well know.
I mean, even words like you, when you hurt yourself, even those are a little bit different.
Yeah.
Or sometimes very different.
And so, well, this word is, I mean, it's a nuanced story in the sense that languages do have their own version of this word, but I can put it like this. Every spoken language that we've been able to check and that anybody else has been able to check has a simple monosyllable that you can, with questioning intonation, that you can use to ask the other to repeat what they just said. And so in some languages it might sound like, hä? That's Dutch, my native language. I think German has a
similar
version of
that.
Now, in English, of course, it sounds a little more nasalized and with a less clear fricative at the beginning, so you don't quite go ha, but more like ah. In Spanish, the vowel is slightly different, so you go e. But still, it's this monosyllable with questioning intonation in all of those languages. So it's never in another part of the vowel space. You know, if you think about it as, you know, one, you know, you can go e or u or a. And then in this region, there would be e and ö and so on. It's always in that region. It's never e or u. Which, you know, there's no particular reason that it couldn't be. But it so happens never to be like that. So that was our first discovery and one of the most interesting ones to do with, you know, how people solve this universal problem.
And the differences that you've seen between languages are linked to phonology, for example.
Exactly.
So a Spaniard would be hard-pressed to pronounce a h, like a H, as we pronounce it.
Yeah.
So, but those are the main differences? And
yeah, the only ones, as far as we can tell. So basically what you can say is this is a word that is always in that same part of the possibility space, and it adjusts slightly within that space to the phonology of the language. That's it. It never, you know, there is no example that we know of where the vowel goes beyond that little A or A sound, for instance. And it so happens, of course, that most languages do have a vowel somewhere there. And then you pick it. That's basically how it works. And the reason that we think this is what we call convergent cultural evolution. We think that across the world, you know, this is such a common communicative need that languages converge to find the same solution, essentially, to that need. And the need is not just, it's not just about, can I get you to say again what you just said, but we're under some pressure. In conversation, we take turns, and we do so at quite an amazing pace. We do so very quickly, normally. And we also know that when we're a bit slower, that invites all sorts of implicatures. So, you know, if you ask me what I'm doing tonight, and I'm slow to reply, you already know that this is going to be I'm busy or whatever.
It's the pragmatics of
Now, so that pressure is always there, and because it's always there, when we didn't quite catch what the other one said in the first place, we need some quick way of indicating that. And that's precisely what this little word gives you. So it's basically the simplest possible question word. It's really easy to plan. You basically just have to leave your mouth open, emit a little air, and you know, make it a syllable with a questioning intonation, and off you go.
And so basically what you're saying is that this was a conversion, I think you said, of languages. This is not just some leftover from an ancient proto-language.
So that's the thing that we are at present, of course, not able to say.
It's difficult to say.
I mean, in fact, you know, when the paper came out, some newspapers with writing about it said, oh, this is the oldest word, it's the most ancient word, it's, you know, the only word that we still have left from our... And it's just, we can't say anything about that. So it could be that. But it could also be that languages independently just converge on that same option. And one reason to think that it's at least partly that second possibility is that we can now see this happening. So Danish is an excellent example. So in Danish, you do have something like Danish is, of course, you know, known as the language that minimizes everything. You know, all the vowels smudged together and so on. So, you know, it makes kind of sense that what they have in the way of this interjection would be just a nasal, like, But they also have another form, which they write with four letters as age, V, A, D. So it's cognate with the Germanic what?
Yeah.
And it sounds nothing like it. It sounds like this. Huh?
It's so Danish.
So there's a tiny bit of labial dental closure there, which, you know, if you really want, you can hear it as la. But it doesn't, you know, if you listen to Dane speaking casually, it just like sounds like that.
Yeah.
Now, what's interesting there is that it seems that the way I look at it is this is the case of the question word in Danish, you know, the one that we know from other Germanic languages to be like what or was and so on. That question word getting caught up in this vortex of sort of selective pressures, wanting this interjection to be minimal.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's being
efficient.
Pulled into that same part of the possibility space where the other interjections of all the other languages already are.
Yeah.
So that's my reason for thinking it's not just that we are stuck with the oldest word, but even if we try to use a new word, it ends up getting pulled towards that same part of the space.
Transcribed text, is that what you use?
Only transcribed audio recordings of informal conversations.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you can never ask somebody about these things because they, you know, you can't trust people's intuition. I can't trust my own intuitions about this because these things are so much below our awareness. You know, ask anybody about whether they think or is a word or whether they think huh is a word. And they'll say, nah, these are just sounds and I don't use them anyway because they're impolite and so on.
Yeah.
Whereas record them in an everyday conversation with their friends and you see them or hear them using these words all the time. So that's what we did. We made recordings in field sites all over the world and traced. We didn't go listening for these sounds in particular. We instead looked for situations in which you can simply see things going wrong. So where you know, you say something and then the other person does something, whatever it is, and then following that something you do your thing again. So you know, you repeat yourself in response to something that the other person did. Now, having these two cases of you speaking and in between a person doing something else, we can look at all of the cases where that person does something and we can say, these are all cases that somehow elicit repetition from you. So those are like what we call repair initiations. Those are cases where I ask you for clarification and then we can do a typology. We can compare them across languages. And that's how we found that one of the things you can reliably do in all those corpora of all those languages is use this simple syllable to elicit a repetition. I would say speech. I would say even it's a word.
Yeah.
Some people think it's not, but
it's just a sound.
It doesn't make sense to me to say it's just a sound because you have to learn it. We found that it's not very common. And
you mean the polite forms are not very common?
Exactly. So even in the most, you know, even in English conversations or, you know, the other Western languages that we had in our sample, we know that these forms exist. But in informal conversations, they are highly infrequent. Instead, what you find is that when there are larger social asymmetries or when there are special, you know, work situations or more formal situations, that's when these things get mobilized. But in informal interaction, in the form that we use language most, these polite forms are least frequent. But they're there, but not in all languages, interestingly. What's so nice about huh is it's extremely efficient. So I put very low demands on your time by using it, and it's a very efficient way of solving that problem. So in a way, it's, you know, it's a good use of our time if I use the most efficient way that's available. What you do when you're being polite is you choose to convert some of the time that you might want to, you know, pay to efficiency. You can choose to convert it to politeness to show that, you know, I'm doing, you know, more work essentially to be more polite. There you go.
Here I go.
Michael wrote a book about it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, there's another cool thing that we found, which was that in all languages, you can do something special with that word to signify that you're doing something special with the meaning. So in particular, what you can do is you can make it more exaggerated, so to say. So you can go, huh? To signify that now it's not just that I didn't hear you. In fact, I heard you quite well, perfectly fine, but I'm doing surprise in a way. I'm acting surprised, and so I invite you now not to repeat it, but just to say, yeah, isn't that, you know, amazing, and so on. And, you know, we know that use from American English and from Dutch. You know, it's been documented in a few Western languages.
Okay.
But it's kind of cool that we've found that in all of the languages in our sample. So no matter where you are, you can do the same thing. You exaggerate the form to, in a way, exaggerate the meaning. And, you know, that same kind of operation on the form to get a particular meaning is available in all those languages. So there are several cues that in simple dyadic interactions that people use. I'm sure you know all of them. The most obvious one is syntax. Does it sound like it's syntactically complete?
Mm-hmm.
But that's never, you know, a single cue. The interesting thing is that these cues are always cumulative.
Mm.
So usually a single cue isn't enough. So complete syntax in itself is just one sort of point in favor of this may be a possible place for a turn transition.
So, for example, when it's a question, you would go up.
But yeah,
then,
yeah.
But that could be a second question after
yeah,
that.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. But that would be two cues already in a way. You can tell something from the syntax. You know, the word order in an English question is different from in a statement. So that's one cue. The other cue is intonation. Does it indeed go up? Then, okay, more evidence it's a question, and therefore now a response is required. And then there are things like, and I'm wondering whether this holds up in this scenario, and I don't think fully, there are things like gaze patterns, which are actually hugely important. So what people do in dyadic interaction is when they are close to finishing their turn, and it is something like a question where, you know, the next speaker is obviously selected as next speaker, then they'll turn their gaze to that speaker.
Yeah.
And then, you know, this is my cue, and now I go. And, you know, if that lines up with the syntax and the intonation and other available cues, then, you know, clearly you can go.
Mm.
And I'm wondering how much of that is available in this, because, you know, essentially all of the turns are pulled apart in this four-person scenario, certainly. So let's keep with Trump and Putin, just because it's easy. So is Trump actually, when asking his question and nearing the end of it, is he going to look at Putin? And if he is, then that is the cue for the interpreter to say, okay, now I know it's basically, you know, the end of the turn, and so I can start translating it. Well, this was a great short conversation. Great to hear about your work and tell a little bit about my work, and lots of follow-up questions.
Yeah, well, same here.
Both of you are remaining in Europe, so I encourage you to.
Yeah, indeed.
We might actually do that.
Yeah,
great.
One person that Michael worked closely with was Charlotte Horn, then the public outreach officer at MPI and a dyed-in-the-wool Dutch woman.
A couple of years ago, she spent 7 months living in New York City. She worked as a bike courier, a job she got as soon as she arrived. How did you think you could work as a courier if you didn't know the city, I asked. She shrugged. I'm Dutch. Dutch people figure if it involves a bike, they can do it.
Charlotte and I spent a lot of time together. Actually, on the first day that I was here, it's 9 o'clock in the morning.
You're here!
I am doing PR and communications for the institute.
Right. Yeah.
So I'm not a researcher.
And were you the one who brought Michael on board?
Well, that was Simon Fisher.
Yeah.
Who is a director here, and he.
Just say yes.
Yes.
Just say yes.
Yes, I did that.
Yeah.
I'm the reason that he's here.
Yeah. Yeah. No. So yes. Yes. No. Yeah, and obviously we worked together just back and forth a little bit with some outreach things or press releases or stories or that kind of thing. Yeah.
And your background is in communication or in science as well?
Neurobiology.
Neurobiology.
Yeah.
And you then decided at some point that you're more interested in the communication aspect of the work.
Yeah. Translating of. Than work,
Translating as in making it
understandable
approach.
Not a different language.
But it is a way of translation.
Yeah.
Well, but also you do work in both English and in Dutch.
I do. I work also in German, but that's because our De Max Planck Gesellschaft obviously is German, and they communicate all their work in German.
Only in German, or
mostly?
Interesting.
Yeah, it's quite interesting because I started working in, and there was no one before that did communication. So I was found a lot, which was really great by a lot of people, but it was a very busy job. So I just got all of these requests, like, we have this, this is cool, this is cool, this is cool. And so I went in a lot indeed and talked to people and I saw the experiments. And at some point, and this is what we spoke about as well, like, what is the Institute actually doing, right?
Yeah.
What is, it's actually the only place in the world where we do only language research all in one building on so many levels. And that is sort of your selling point. But there's a lot of really interesting work here, obviously. So
yeah, I was just saying to Michael, you could pop into any office and you could have a three-hour conversation, which would be fascinating.
Yeah. Mm. People are so driven and so open, and
I should have done that. Actually, just had like a random number generator.
Yeah.
And just spun the wheel, and every day, like, let's see what's happening in 2017.
Yeah.
Yeah, because even if you're here for a year, you don't get to meet everyone necessarily.
No, I mean, there's so much you realize at the beginning, like, oh my God, I'm in a candy store.
Exactly.
And by November, you go, I'm so tired of candy.
Too much like, candy.
I can't eat any more candy. So you got to step back and digest it a little bit.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.